Rabbi Tarrigan has been a Ram at Yeshivat Har Etzion in Gush Etzion for the past 27 years and currently teaches at the Abraham Beit Midrash for Women of Yeshivat Har Etzion. He is truly a Marbit Torah. He is the author of an internet shiur entitled Talmudic Methodology, which has over 5,000 subscribers, a weekly shiur on Pirkei Avot with over 1,400 subscribers, and has delivered literally hundreds of audio shiurim on the Yeshivat Har Etzion audio-based medrash, as well as YU Torah online. Rabbi Tarrigan has authored a Yom HaAtzmaut Machzor for the Koren Publishing House, and he and his wife and their 8 children reside in Gush Etzion. As always, you are going to have 2 opportunities to ask questions of Rabbi Tarrigan. You may unmute yourself at any point in time to do so. And after he has completed his presentation, you will have another opportunity to ask questions. So now I'd like to go ahead and turn the program over to Rabbi Tarrigan, and we welcome you. Glad to have you today.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. I think you read my resume, but you left out the most important part. I'm good friends with Howard, and I'm one of Daniel's rabbanim. So that's the most important part of my yichus there.
Howard made the initial connection, and we're very grateful for that. So.
But thank you. Thank you for the warm invitation, the warm welcome. It's really an honor. I didn't know there were 29. That's a really impressive figure. So, Ken Yerbu, Mitzvah Hashem, we should have the pleasure to actually sit and learn together and share Torah together in person when all this madness passes. But until that, it's a great opportunity to share some Torah and to be part of this series. And Pesach and Mitzrayim is really a stratified story. It's a story of stories, many layers to it. There's a historical drama about God reviving an ancient promise that had gone dormant for 200 years, promised to our forefathers that he now resuscitated. It's a theological drama, the debut of monotheism in a world of pagan idolatry. It's a political drama, political, socio-political upheaval, downtrodden slaves overthrowing the reigning totalitarian regime. There's so many layers and so many narratives, but there's also a psychological narrative. For some reason, God decided not to superimpose redemption upon history, but to work through history, to work through human agencies and human instruments, as he does today. We all think of redemption in apocalyptic terms, as if the temple comes gyrating from heaven, superimposed upon an unaccommodating historical reality. And sometimes Hashem decides to work through history, and it's frustrating. It's a little bit more gradual and staccato than we'd like it to be. And Hashem chose to work through Paro's heart, and it was so obvious to Paro. The writing's on the wall. Plagues, afflictions, death, pandemics. I mean, we've suffered only 1 of 10. And look how existential our own experience has been, thinking about our society, our culture, our world, our personal lives, changes and adjustments. Why didn't Paro listen? It should have been so obvious to him. Well, there really are 2 parts to that question. One part I will avoid because it doesn't really dovetail with the STEM topic or theme. And that's, well, how could HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervene in his heart? Isn't that the realm of personal autonomy, a realm which Hashem already demarcated as human possessed and in no ways admitting God's entry? That's a very important theological question. If I have time, maybe I'll address that. But putting aside Hashem's intervention, it's clear that Paro refused. He was obstinate. He was stubborn. The writing's on the wall. It's clear. There's input. There's feedback. Should be obvious. And he doesn't. And I think it's the story of every man. Because we're better talkers than we are listeners. And we like looking at screens, not at mirrors, because mirrors look back. And sometimes there are people in our lives, there are events, there are messages that can help us change who we are. If not existentially, at least incrementally, we'd always listen. And part of the story of Mitzrayim is how to become a better listener, how to take Paro's stubbornness and obstinacy and ramp it down, because they're not Paro's, but ramp it down into our own lives and think about how we can better listen to the voices in our world, the messages, the change that can transform us as people. So that's to this afternoon's topic. Why did Paro listen? Why don't we listen? And if you look carefully, and I'll flip back and forth between the source sheet, which Steve so kindly made available to you, and I'll share the screen. If you look carefully, there are 3 different terms Throughout the story of Shmos through B'Shalach, which describes Pyro's refusal, his resistance. And we'll discuss each of those terms and try to trace it to our own inner psychological landscape. One is Koshi Leif. You can see source number one, which I'll just interpret now as hard-hearted. Pyro was hard-hearted in part because of his own doing, in part because of Hashem's intervention. Pyro was also a Chozek Leif, ani Chazeket Leif Pyro, which is a little bit different. It's not hard. It's more strong, forceful, potent. It's a potent heart. Then the third phrase, which is probably the most elusive, is Kaved Leif, he had a heavy heart. These are all very loose and literal translations. So when do we suffer from Koshi Leif? When do we suffer from Chozek Leif? And when do we suffer from Kovid Leif? None of us are totalitarian despots. We don't subjugate millions of people. But sometimes it's the faceless tyrannies in our life that are the hardest to overthrow because they're less visible. So the first phrase, Koshi Leif, actually appears only once. So you have to really grab it in the beginning of Shmos, where Hashem introduces the whole process to Moshe, source number Aleph, and I color-coded them for you, so this is blue. Ani aksha eslav paro. The word kasha means hard, really stiff. It conjures up the image of a dried or desiccated plant that's gone hard, or something without life or vitality, a stone. It's hard. And what it probably refers to are people that become insensitive, numb. The heart is normally the heart, the general thorax, the general area of our heart. We normally feel emotions very deeply. We feel other people's emotions. We sympathize with them. And sometimes our heart goes stiff and hard. It's hard-hearted. We become insensitive or apathetic. We don't allow those emotions to enter the same way that it would not enter, or that there's no life, there's no response from a stone. We'll talk about a stone later, or dried fruit or vegetable. And we don't sense, we anesthetize our heart, we go numb. So for example, the only other place in Tanakh where this phrase appears is in Mishlei, about someone who's careless and reckless instead of cautious and careful. Asher adam mefachei tamid. It's good sometimes to be fearful, to be conservative. Fear is a great preserver of human life. It alerts us to danger. It cautions us against irresponsible behavior. And the antithesis is makshelibo, someone that strengthens his heart. Makshelibo yipol berah. So there's the other time in Tanakh that the word akshelev appears. And it's someone that refuses to feel fear. Fear is a healthy emotion. Fear governs our behavior. The inability or the unwillingness to sense fear is referred to as maksha libo, where the heart goes hot, where the heart goes hard and the sensations and the emotions can't enter. Now, Paro was, of course, a radical or extreme version of this. An extreme version of Koshi Leiv is what we would call a psychopath. A psychopath is someone that has the following two afflictions. He's someone who is insensitive to suffering, and he has deviant moral judgment. The combination of those two, the inability to render moral judgment, and the inability to sense human suffering, renders someone a psychopath. Now, a person can become a psychopath in part through hatred. Hatred is an all-consuming emotion. Chazal referred to this as sinah, mikalkeles es hashura. It distorts our vision, our ration. Paro was a psychopath. How do we know he was a psychopath? Because the night of Makas Bechoros, the Medrash tells us, the firstborn rioted outside of the palace. Because all of Moshe's prophecies and foreshadowings had been actualized, and now they were in the crosshairs. So they were begging Pyro to release the Jews. And Pyro was so obstinate and so full of hate and vengeance that he was even willing to endanger his own firstborn. I think a lot about that when I think about Hitler during the latter stages of World War II, warring against the Russians in Stalingrad and against the Allied troops on the shores of France, and still dedicating resources to hunting down isolated Jews in cellars in Budapest. And there are first-person accounts of soldiers intending to arrive at the German front, German soldiers who were left stranded on train platforms watching Gestapo and SS trains drive by with Jews or drive by to collect or to terrorize Jews. And it's the nature of psychopathy, insensitivity to moral suffering, absence of correct moral judgment, that to me would seem the most extreme form of akshay lev, where you don't feel suffering, basic response to human suffering, to human hardship, basic attuning to moral judgment. I don't think any of us are psychopaths, and most of us feel fear. We don't fall into the trap of the pasuk in Mishlei, source number two, or bet. But I think there's a different danger that we often fall into. And it's when we choose to be insensitive, we choose to ignore contradictions between our values and our behavior, or we choose to ignore the consequences of our behavior. It's not natural to us. It doesn't define us, but we make those choices. We compartmentalize ourselves emotionally and behaviorally. And I think we call that cognitive dissonance. We make a decision to separate parts of our lives, our values from our behavior, our values from contradictory values. So it's all on the spectrum. That's a form of koshi lev. We just don't admit certain feedback into our hearts, into our existence, into our identity, because it's just easier for us. It's more convenient to ignore it. So we make that choice. We choose to ignore the future consequences of our behavior. If you take a look at source number Gimel, there's a very jarring expression of this, where a person says, V'haya b'shamo, this is in Parshat Nitzavim, es divrei Allah zo. So he hears about all the consequences of betraying God. V'sbarech b'lvavo, but he justifies and he assures himself in his heart, Shalom yieli, I'll be fine, I'll be at peace. Ki b'shrirut li be'elech, I'll just follow my own moral self-arbitration. Shrirut is a difficult word to interpret, but you clearly see a cognitive dissonance where you've read the Torah, you've read Kitavo, you understand cause and effect. Promise is pretty clear. It's pretty difficult to avoid them, but you retreat back into your own inner narrative, your own inner fiction. I'll follow my own path. That's not about me. Parshas Kitavo is about the other person. My life, and the Torah is not describing me. I'm part of a different, I'm autonomous. I've got my own narrative. Sometimes we choose not just to compartmentalize ourselves emotionally, but we choose to just numb ourselves emotionally. We become very detached or estranged from our emotional surroundings, become very disinterested, disconnected emotionally. And that's another form of koshi lev, where your heart becomes barren or barrier to input into emotions. So that's the first struggle that Paro portrays. Vaniach shes leif Paro, in Paro's case, it was psychopathic. It was hatred. And it was murder, insensitivity, despotism, exploitation. We're nowhere near that climate of Paro's life, but we do find ourselves having koshi leif, where we face certain consequences and we choose to ignore them. We face certain futures, which our behavior probably triggers, but we claim that we'll follow our own arc, our own trajectory, our own, especially in the modern world. The modern world is much more subjectivist, much more existentialist. We think less collectively, more individually, which is fantastic for human empowerment, for creativity, for personal expression, and for achievement. But sometimes it creates moral isolationism, where we feel like we're different and whatever is written about others, we're not part of that story. We have our own narrative. We have our own internal shriut li be'elech. And redemption, and this is a season of redemption, it's not just geographical or national, it's also emotional and existential. And Yechezkel describes koshi lev, but through a poetic metaphor. Yechezkel says, V'natati lehem lev echad v'ruach hadasha atein b'kir b'chem. Good phrase for Israeli elections. Lev echad, unity. Pretty elusive. V'hasiroti lev ha'even mipsaram. I will remove the stone heart from their flesh. See the contrast between stone and flesh. V'natati lehem lev basar. And I will implant a fleshly heart. Now, we don't need Rashi to describe this for us, but he does anyway. Rashi says lev basar means lev rach, a soft, feeling, emotional, v'noach lehichana. That's why I think it's so important to become a sympathetic person, to become a compassionate person, because if you are emotionally detached from others, very often you can become emotionally detached from yourself. Emotions are very tricky that way. And most of the emotional interface we build with other people tends to dominate the emotional interface we build with ourselves. We're not discussing dishonesty tonight. But one of the dangers of being a chronic liar, even if you tell yourself it's always a white lie and another white lie, is you'll lose the capacity to discern truth from falsehood. And that is absolutely handicapping for personal growth, because personal growth is pivoted upon honesty and courage. The honesty to see yourself clearly and authentically, unflinchingly, and the courage to make change once you've processed who you are and who you'd like to be. So emotional disconnectedness from other people, inability to sympathize with other people, to share your emotions with other people, to sense other people's emotions, can be extremely damaging or inhibiting for your own ability to sense your own emotions, your own emotional inner world. So this is the first, I wouldn't call it pathology, but I'd call it psychological challenge. It's called Koshi Lev. The second is probably more classic. It's not Koshi Lev, but Chozek Lev. And unlike Koshi Lev, which, as I said before, appears only once, at least in the Shmos story, it appears in Mishle in a different context. Chozek Lev, I didn't count it, but it appears about 13 times. So this is really the dominant central pathology or psychological barrier which Pyro struggles with and ultimately fails with. And unlike the first one, which is emotional, psychological, this is psychology being driven by socioeconomic success. It's power is successful. And when we're successful, we feel empowered. We feel confident. We feel self-assured. And that very often bleeds into arrogance, obdurance, cockiness, self-righteousness, supreme confidence, superiority complex. And that's what Pyro felt. Pitch this story, this face-off between Hashem and Pyro in the context of two parallel face-offs between God and humanity in Brejit. The first face-off was the Mabul, the second face-off was Migdal Babel. Everything else is recovery. So this is the third face-off between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and humanity. I wouldn't call the Mabul a face-off. It's not a contest. Man had lost his way, morally wayward, and Hashem made a unilateral decision. There's no choice. He didn't offer man a choice. Similarly with Migdal Babel. And we'll call that a competition between two great potents or two great powers. But Mitzrayim very much is, because Mitzrayim had achieved, was a superpower of the ancient world that achieved dominance, political, economic dominance, in part because of the Nile River, the innate fertility, the ability to withstand famines, to feed the world. This was the cradle of civilization. This was the empire of that period, of that epoch. And there's a face-off between man's greatest and most powerful and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And you'd have to wait about, I don't know, probably about 700 years till a face-off of this magnitude occurs again between Hashem and Nebuchadnezzar. That's the next point in history which one human being can achieve such supremacy, such total dominion over his world, and faced off with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is the second reason Pyro doesn't listen. He's just not too proud, but too confident in his own accomplishments. So it's harder for us to listen as we age because we become more accomplished and more settled. I read articles from several newspapers. I wrote about this a few weeks ago. In Parshas Vayakol Pekuda, I found Corona very reductive. It has taken me back to an earlier stage of my life, ironically, because so much of the successes that I hid behind and that I thought formed my identity have been taken from me. And my self-identity has become much more existential. It's not about my profession. It's not about my activities. It's not about my travel. It has to be about me in the mirror, me and my wife, my family and I, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu and I. It can't be about anything else because those are all teetering on the brink of too fragile to bank or to pivot my identity upon. This is how Chazal understood the face-off. It's a fascinating medrash. Source number Tezayin. V'chizakti eslev paro. Notice the language of v'chizakti. This language. Amar Shimon ben Lakish. Mashal lebet athletim. Two athletes. And I'm speaking to some Chicagoans, right? Michael Jordan and Kobe. Two athletes. Right. Echad chalash. One is weak. The echad gibor. One is strong. So this is literally a face-off between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Pyro. empowers the successful despot of the most successful super empire of that era. That accounts for two very interesting phenomena about this phrase. Remember, there are three phrases, the phrase of Koshi Lev, Chozek Lev, and Kovid Lev. This phrase, Vayechazak Hashem, Vayechazak Hashem, V'chizakti, Vayechazak Lev Paro, only appears with regard to Paro, not his countrymen. The other phrases we'll see have a broader sweep. Kaved Lev is not just Paro, but his slaves, and not just his slaves, but his soldiers, and not just his soldiers, but we'll see later, other armaments of war. But the phrase Chozek Lev is reserved solely for Paro, because this is a face-off of man's potency against HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's also why this phrase is so frequent specifically, or so prevalent specifically, in Parshas Bishalach. As in Parshas Bishalach, we read not about the scenes of Egypt, but the scenes of the Yamsuf. And as much as Egypt was a face-off on many ways and many levels, and as much as the Ten Makos, this is a little bit of a sidebar, the Medrash says one of the ways to metaphorically interpret the Makos is it crystallized ancient warfare, was a metaphor for ancient warfare. In ancient war, you'd first shut off the water, then you'd make loud clashing sounds all night to discombobulate and disorient your enemy. Lord of the Rings, a lot of loud sounds and clasping spears. And then you send in the air force, the arrows, the bows and arrows. And then you send in the freaks to rampage through town and to kill and murder and rape. But they would at some point subdue these giants. And then you set the town on fire with oil, and you throw boulders at the defense fortresses, and then you send in the army, because if you send in the army too early, you'll suffer casualties. The Makos consisted of a metaphoric war. First, the water was shut down. Then there were the sounds of the Tzvardeah, and then the skin-piercing Kenim, and then the freaks of the wild beasts, and then the hot oil of the Shchin, and then the boulders of the Barad, and then the locust, which symbolized uniformed, endless swarms of soldiers. Standardized soldiers. And it was important for Hashem to demonstrate to the Jews that he knew how to wage war, because the original plan had the Jews leaving Egypt Tesvav Nisan, receiving the Torah 7 weeks later, walking into Israel 15 days later, arriving in mid-June, fighting 31 empires, and ushering in utopia with the Beis HaMikdash by Rosh Hashanah. History was meant to be 2,448 years long, and that's it. We were not meant to live in England or Spain, France, Russia, Morocco, North Africa, Chicago, Brooklyn. We're meant to arrive immediately in Israel and close history with the advance towards utopia, but we failed. But in order to give them the confidence that God knew how to wage war, Hashem had to demonstrate in Mitzrayim his war skills, military skills. But if war in Egypt was metaphoric, war in Mitzrayim, war at the Yamsuf, was actual. There were horses, there were chariots, there was fire, there was face-off, there was drowning. It was a military clash. Paro didn't send his countrymen. Paro sent the steeds. Paro sent the revolutionary guards. This was a war. And that's why specifically at this point, the phrase of Chozek Yad is employed. Chozek Yad. Chani chizakti eslev Paro. Chizakti eslev Paro. Beginning with source Yud Gimel, Yud Daled, Tesvav. These are all Bishalach Psukim. Not for Aaron Bobsukim. And the conclusion of that face-off was not the defeat of Paro, but the exploitation or the manipulation of Paro's authority for God's use. That whatever human beings achieve is God-given, and God can not just withdraw it, but God can also channel it and direct it. And that's why the very, very beginning, right before any of the Makos begin, Hashem informs Moshe, source number 2, Aleph, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Ata tireh asher eseh leparo, ki biyad chazaka yishalachem, uviyad chazaka yigarshem me'artzo. His strength will be the instrument of the redemption, of their release. Yad chazaka of Paro, of course, Hashem possesses the yad chazaka. So Paro is a chozek lev, because of his accomplishment prior to this episode, but by the end, and so it occurs. What happens by the end? Vatechazak Mitzrayim al ha'am lemaher lishalacham min haaretz. Paro's strength now is used, counterproductive as far as he's concerned, as an instrument of Hashem's will. And by the end of Shmos, while we're retelling the story to our children, Zachar esayom azer sheyutzasim mimitzrayim yibeis avadim ki bechozek yad hotzi Hashem escha mizeh velo yechel chametz. So all of human strength, which wrongfully stiffened Paro's resolve and created more stubbornness by the end, was an instrument for HaKadosh Baruch Hu appearing as the Chozek Yad, which is why the pasuk I didn't quote, which is why we put tefillin on our weaker hand, because we reserve the stronger hand for Hashem. The source for putting tefillin on the weaker hand is the next pasuk I didn't quote, Vayalios al Yadcha Yud Dalet Chafei, which Chazal interpreted to be the weaker hand, because the weaker hand in this context is crucial because it reserves the stronger hand for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Ki bechozek yad hatzi Hashem eschem yizeh, but it really wasn't. It's a dangling modifier. It doesn't say ki biyad chazak hatzi Hashem eschem yizeh. That would refer to Hashem's strong hand, as it does in Kitavo, which we read in the Haggadah. It's yad Hashem lokeinu Hashem biyad chazakah. But here it says ki bechozek yad. That's not the hand of Hashem. That's just a capacity. Ki bechozek yad. Who's chozek yad? Is it Hashem's chozek yad, or is it Paro's chozek yad? It ultimately is Paro's authority that releases the Jews and drives them out of Egypt. There's a Kodesh Baruch Hu driving the engine of this authority. So this is the central drama of Yitzias Mitzrayim, not Akshes Lev Paro, but Chozek Lev. Strength through success, cockiness, arrogance, self, the superiority complex, refusal to listen, I'm better than, I'm accomplished, who are you to tell me? I know better, I've been successful. And as we grow older, and as Baruch Hashem, we become more successful, it becomes even more difficult to change because we get locked into our own prisons of self-confidence. What about the third one? The third one is the most intriguing because it's the least obvious. Where Paro's heart is hardened. Kaved leiv Paro, v'achbed es libo, v'achbed, it becomes heavy. What does it mean his heart becomes heavy? And what does this have to do with us? So I'm going to split this conversation into two. One is Chazal's definition of kaved libo. And then I'll offer my own, which I think is based on a different pasuk in Tanakh. It's a more literal reading. Chazal saw this phrase as kaved es libo, hachbed es libo, as a play on words, because the heart, the word lev, becomes a kaved. Kaved is the Hebrew word for liver. So Paro's heart became a liver. Now Chazal would say this twice. Source Yud Beis. If I wouldn't show you the mission, the matters, you wouldn't believe me. This is too good to be true. I have to show you that it's actually true. Ma hakaved kais af libo shel ze nase kaved. Paro's heart becomes a liver. A little bit later on, the only time it happens. Mahuich badati source yudalit shasa kadosh baruch was libo ki kaved hazeh. Shem converts Paro's heart into a liver. So obviously it doesn't mean that Hashem played around with Paro's anatomy. the old operation games where we have to perform operation on that little man with the red nose and it beat every time. Shem wasn't playing operation with Paro. It's metaphoric. It's symbolic. What's the difference between a heart and a liver? So the heart is very muscular, but it's actually very light because it's a pump. And during the time that it's in action, there's nothing contained in the heart. There's no liquid, there's no blood in the heart. The blood moves in, moves out, moves in, moves out. So if you were to extract a heart from someone, it'd be very light. The muscle would be heavy, but liver is very heavy because it's not a pump. It's a basin. It's a depot. It's where the blood settles and rests and remains and lingers to be filtered and cleansed. Liver is a very, very heavy, heavy organ. That's why it's called kaved, because it's heavy. It's fed both by arteries, veins, as well as the bile systems. Actually, it's laced with many, many blood feeds. This is, Steve has felt I should give a shout out to some of the STEM conversations. So the liver is a very heavy organ, which is why it's called a kaved. The heart is very light and is empty. What does it mean when your heart becomes a liver and you're unable to process? And it's because your heart is filled with too many other emotions. And it becomes heavy and preoccupied, as we would say psychologically, and you're just too full with other emotions to process new information, new input, new ideas. We'd call it emotional preoccupation. When there's too much, as we would say, on your heart, the heavy heart. Now, again, sometimes it occurs in very, very extreme form. Our schedules are too busy. And our hearts are too occupied to listen, to think, to process. I sometimes think about someone, unfortunately, there was a very well-known Israeli personality who's recently been accused of sexual misconduct. Unfortunately, it looks as if much of the accusations are at least reflective of the fact that he was leading a double life. And I just think about people who lead double lives and the sheer energy and resources it must take psychologically and emotionally to keep those two lives separate and tandem. And there's great release in authenticity. I don't feel as if I have to be a different person when I'm in the Karashah or I'm in the Tarakana. It's just being myself. I don't need a separate me. There's only one me. I don't have to put on airs. I don't have to act. I don't have to put on some other emotional uniform. It's being myself. And it's very cool. It's very calming. Sometimes you can be yourself. Once you hit that stride in life and you have that confidence to be yourself, it just alleviates the pressure of performance. You don't have to perform for people. When you come home, you don't have to perform for your wife. You don't have to perform for your children. You are who you are. Once you can extend that lack of performance, lack of showmanship, the broader world, it reduces the strain, reduces the stress. So Paro was just busy. When you think about the pace of the 10 Makos, it was furious. It was frenetic. By the time one had disappeared, the next one arrived, and there was internal foment, and Moshe Rabbeinu was gaining in popularity. He's a very busy man, and his heart was just the liver. He couldn't process it. He was just too busy. Now, for us, aside from busyness, I sometimes think that our heart becomes preoccupied, let's say emotionally, where there's too many emotions that take over our heart and they weigh on our heart disproportionately, become full of sadness, full of jealousy, full of obsession, full of guilt, full of desire, full of greed. We call it emotional baggage. And if you're able to modulate and calibrate your emotions, and certainly to try as best you can is eliminate some of these toxic emotions, but at least not to let them obsess. Sometimes think of the last time you became emotionally preoccupied because one of those emotions or a different emotion just overcame you and dominated you. And you weren't able to climb out from under that emotion. It's almost like a shadow was over. A shadow doesn't have to be a shadow of depression. It could be a shadow of desire, a shadow of ambition, a shadow of greed, a shadow. So think when our hearts turn into a liver, it's because our hearts, which should normally move emotions in and out, should feel emotions. Emotions are important, shouldn't be trivialized, but it's like blood. It moves in, you feel the emotion, it has its time, it has its place, and you move on to another context. Same way a heart absorbs the blood, pumps the blood, moves it along. When your heart becomes a liver, then those emotions just settle in and reside and weigh down on your heart. And power was weighted down. Heart became a liver. Chazal talk about anger. Really don't see too much anger with Paro. Towards the end, he becomes angry. Talks about the anger which turned his heart into a liver. This is a Medrash source, Yud Beis. It's an interesting pasuk, which I forgot to quote, so I'll now share it on a different screen. One second. It's a pasuk in Mishle that captures heaviness of anger in particular. It's a pasuk in Mishle. Kovet Evan Venetel Achol, a heavy stone, something else which is heavy. Vikas Avil, but the anger of a fool, Kovet Mishneim, is heavier than sand or heavier than a stone. So anger is described as heavy. If we think about it emotionally, we won't think that anger is heavy. It's electric, it's a fuse, it's consuming. But it's heavy because once it settles in, right? When's the last time you couldn't get past your anger? It inhibited your overall decision-making, your life, your relationships, because it was too heavy. So emotions can become very heavy for us. Guilt can become very heavy. So that's Chazal's description of hachbeit es libo, that his heart became a liver, or their hearts became a liver, because it was just too much, became too preoccupied. But I think there's a simpler interpretation. And it's, of course, meant to complement Chazal. It's not meant to disagree. When we think of the word kaved, we associate it not with the liver, probably doctors do, but we associate it with the word kavod, with honor. And sometimes we don't listen because we feel too much honor. Let me describe that in a moment. Let's take a look at a pasuk in Shmuel Aleph, where it's berating those who worship idolatry and asking them to ignore or to debase their idols, unetatem leloke Yisrael kavod, and give honor to Hashem. So that's pasuk, hey, kavod. The very next pasuk, lama tichabdu et levavchem. Instead of giving honor to Hashem, why are you honoring your hearts? You see the interplay between giving kavod and heavy hearts. And by the way, what's the template for heavy hearts? Kasher kibdu mitzrayim uparo eslivam. Throw back to Parsha Shmos. The Nevi's saying, give kavod to Hashem instead of giving kavod to your hearts and not listening as the Egyptians did. So this is our code. Without this pasuk, it would be hard to make the claim, but this is our pasuk. Now, what does it mean when we don't listen because we give ourselves too much honor? I don't think this means the glib, cocky arrogance of Chozek Lev. Honor is really important to human identity. It's really important to emotional well-being. We have to honor ourselves. What do we call that? We call that self-esteem. Self-esteem means we believe in ourselves. We believe in our values. We have a good feeling about ourselves. It's crucial towards emotional well-being. Sadly today, for various reasons, there is a scarcity of emotional well-being and self-esteem that leads to a lot of abuse. Abusers need to extract attention from people to substitute for self-esteem. And victims don't have enough self-esteem to say, I don't deserve this treatment. So with self-esteem, a lot of abuse can be prevented. So self-esteem is really important. It's important for us to feel proud of who we are, not in an arrogant way, in a proportionate way, to value our lives, to value our viewpoints, to value our relationships, to value our achievements, to value our who we are as people, self-worth. But with that comes a sense of independence, individualism, right? We self-esteem. We esteem ourselves because we say, I'm different from you, and I have my values, my views, my life, my style, and that's important to me, and I'm proud of it. I'm proud of who I'm trying to become. Change threatens the established you, the established identity, because change demands you forfeit a little bit of that individualism. You have to give in a little bit of whom you are to this new idea, to this new input, to this new value, to this new challenge. To move out of your here and now. And it's really hard. It's hard to give up yourself. Not because you're cocky, not because you're arrogant, not because you're psychopathic or you're insensitive. Not because you're preoccupied, because change is going to transform me and change me, and I'm comfortable with the me because I'm proud of the me. And how do you thread the needle between self-esteem, kavod, and change? I don't mean kavod in an unhealthy way, in an addictive way. I mean in the best way. Self-esteem and a sense of your individual, unique identity. If that is too deeply reinforced, then it's a barrier against change. Because you're too proud of you. Not proud. Proud is a difficult word. You're too content. How do you become content without being complacent? That's the challenge of kavod. And that's why, interestingly enough, the word kavod is used about inanimate objects at the Yom Suf. By the way, keep in mind, the Avram kaved me'od, but Betzenu v'bakar. Remember, whenever Avram has a lot of cattle, it becomes kaved me'od. Because he becomes a more important person. He becomes someone, after he exits from Egypt, he now has cattle, he now has livestock, and he has every reason to look at himself differently. Not in arrogant. Avram's never arrogant. He's never kaved me'od. At the Yom Suf, and I'm not going to read all the psukim where kaved appears, but it appears in the beginning of Shmos about the work, tichbad ha'avoda. But at the Yom Suf, it appears fascinating, not just about Paro, but about the soldiers and more. So I'm starting with source chet. The chizakti et leiv paro, so paro's heart will be more self-assured, more cocky. Okay. V'radav achareihem, v'ikavda b'fara, uv'chol chelo. I'll make them feel their kavod too much. V'ikavdi b'fara, b'rechba b'fara shav. So now, it's not just paro, but the chariots and the horses are going to be heavy. Vayasar es ofan markiv osav. So now the wheels are off. Literally, the wheels come flying off. Vayinahageu bichvedut. And now the chariots become heavy because the wheels aren't functioning and they're stuck in the mud. Why are the chariots being targeted with kvedut? Because human beings manufacture chariots so they don't have to walk in the mud, unlike animals. Or cars, or horses, or planes, or shoes, or trains. Transportation is an expression of human creativity because we honor ourselves, because we believe we shouldn't be walking through mud and dredge and dirt. We should be riding on something which reflects the dignity of the human condition because we respect our dignity. We believe in our dignity. And we comport ourselves and preserve our dignity. But the preservation of dignity is a flip side of honoring humanity and honoring ourselves, which we try to do. But if it's too much, it's too extreme, then it becomes a barrier against change. These are three different modes of emotional barriers that Paro faces. His heart becomes insensitive, numb. Psychopathic levels, our hearts sometimes become cognitively dissonant, compartmentalized. He becomes too prideful, too vain, too arrogant, too self-righteous. Chozek leiv. This is a face-off between the ruler of the ancient human realm and God in heaven. We know how that ends. Third challenge is kovod leiv. Chazal see this as the heart becoming too heavy. I see it in addition as the heart becoming too protective of itself in a legitimate way. And very, very briefly, that's how I feel we can begin to solve the theological problem I alluded to earlier today. How could God intervene in human identity? The answer is he's not intervening in human identity. These are all emotions. And emotions which we carefully calibrate throughout our lifetime. It's not identity. We aren't our emotions. There's something deeper than emotions, which is who you are. You can understand your emotions, gauge your emotions, suppress your emotions, express your emotions, balance your emotions. These are all emotional states of the heart that we struggle with. On the one hand, we want to be defiant. We want to be kosher lev at some point. It's important at some point to be insensitive. If you feel you have something important to accomplish, but obviously if you become too insensitive, too apathetic, it's important to be confident in ourselves, but not cocky. It's important to have self-esteem, but not to the point that it prevents change. It's important to feel emotions, but not to the point that it preoccupies our heart. Now, can HaKadosh Baruch Hu challenge us in this emotional calibration? Of course he can. If I'm working on my desires and all of a sudden I see an attractive woman, then Hashem has challenged my ability to calibrate my emotional desires. Now, why has Hashem challenged me and not you? Or why has he challenged me at this point? Only he knows, but that's not a betrayal of Bechira Chavshas. Because my Bechira Chavshas, my free choice, my free will resides at a level of identity deeper than my emotions. And there could be challenges to my emotional calibration, but my identity and moral will should be strong enough to navigate those challenges. So in Mitzrayim, for whatever reason, Hashem challenged the process of Koshi Leiv calibration that we all go through. We all need Koshi Leiv. We all need sometimes to be, I just spent the day with my grandchildren all over the house. I had to be a little bit insensitive when my child wanted his 15th candy. My wife doesn't have any Koshi Leiv, but I had to say, no more candy for you. That point was an easy one, obviously, because it was so obvious it was only Koshi Leiv in the limited manifestation, but I couldn't give in to his crying because he had too much candy. So we calibrate our Koshi Leiv with our sympathy, and we have to know when. We calibrate our Chozek Leiv. We want to use our successes as motivation. We want to feel confident about our potential, but not to the point that it borders on cockiness and condescension. We want to feel emotions deeply, but not too deeply. We want to have honor and respect for ourselves, but not to the point that we become too imprisoned or too locked into our own conventions and profiles and realities and social cues. Now, can HaKadosh Baruch Hu challenge those calibrations? Of course he can. Why does he? It's a different story. When does he? Why does he choose to? But that isn't an invasion of Bechira Chashis. That's just provoking a greater response in one of these emotional challenges that we all go through. And these are the three challenges of Para. And that's how we can learn a little bit more about ourselves. And that's why the Torah delineates this emotional journey in Para.
Great. Thank you very, very much. Any questions?
Yes. Harav, what role does time play, especially in the Chozek Yad? For example, I don't know how long it took for the Makos to play out. But, you know, once one Maka is done and Paro gets his way and the Maka ends, you know, over what period of time was there a cool down period for that Chozek Yad to rejuvenate after the defeat or the suffering of a particular Maka and spread over 10, especially with Makos Bechoros? We know how that ended. But how does time as a variable fit into this equation?
It's a great question. I think the pre-question is, why isn't the Torah more deliberate about the time schedule and the timelines? Why doesn't the Torah say this happened and then that happened? Afterwards, it becomes pretty clear. The second month, the first year, this happened and then occurred. And the timelines are all confusing. I think it's part of redemption. The redemption accelerates through chipazon, not just on that night. And timelines get convoluted. Rashi quotes two positions. I think it's Rashi and Vayera, Rashi and Bo, about whether the Makkah lasted the entire month or only lasted 2 weeks out of the month. But it was clear that it all unfolded in the course of a year. So whether there was a week in between or 2 weeks in between, the cooling off period was not that extensive. It's not as if he had months and months to consider. He had at the most 2 weeks, possibly three, to consider penitence and to alter his plans. I'm inferring from your question that had he had more time, maybe it would have come around. It would be more reasonable to expect the transformation. Although we also know that sometimes we have to grab these moments of emotional epiphany when they happen. And whether we return back to our routines and to our regular lives, it becomes harder to lock in those change.
Yeah, actually, it was the opposite. I mean, if they had been literally back-to-back, no break, Dantz Radia Kini Marov, you know, boom, 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 I would fully understand the Chozek Yad. Right. I would, where you'd like, I'm digging in. But if there's this period of reflection in between these horrific events, at some point you'd be like, I'm done. After the third one, like how much of this can, it's Groundhog Day for the whole world. Right. And everything seems the same and it's schlepping on. And this period of reflection that the Rev referred to, that makes a lot of sense. I was just wondering what role that could have played in Paro's calculation, if it was even a conscious calculation, as opposed to just sort of his instinct kicking in.
I think it's a fantastic point. Again, my mind is working back to the first part of that question. Why doesn't HaKadosh Baruch Hu show us these timelines? Why doesn't he say on the second month and the third month? It certainly has the sense that these are happening back to back, literally. So why is that the story the Torah tells rather than make it more apparent that there's breaks and hiatus in between? An interesting question. Never thought of it that way.
That could be the next year.
Okay. Any other questions from anyone? If not, then Rabbi Tarrigan, here's what I have to say to you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, and thank you. First thank you is for a wonderful presentation. The second thank you is for doing this 5 days before Pesach. The third thank you is for doing this in the evening, although we're in the middle of the day. And the fourth thank you is taking great care of my grandson, Daniel, for 2 years at your yeshiva. So we're very thankful for all of those things. We appreciate it. After today's STEM lecture, we're going to go on hiatus for a few weeks. We're taking a break for the following reason. Our speakers, as you all know, are very busy, and they're also sharing the responsibility of Pesach with their families, and we know how much time that takes. And that combination has made it very difficult for us to